You're listening to episode 12 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order Ogcast, and this is episode 12 of season 6. It's a nice, bright, summer sort of morning, and I am sipping some coffee, some new coffee that I've previously not tried. It's called Wind Farm Coffee. And the reason that I'm mentioning this is because the coffee was sent to me by Pokey. Pokey, you'll know from Hacker Public Radio. He's kind of the sticker guy right now and doing a lot of like book reviews and lots of interesting episodes and a pretty funny ad that you might hear on other podcasts and stuff for Hacker Public Radio that his mom actually did the ad, so it's pretty amusing. But yeah, the coffee's really good, and thanks to Pokey for sending that to me along with the HPR stickers. It was completely unexpected and not something that I want anyone else to do, because then I'd feel like I was selling out, you know, by asking for free stuff from the audience, like, oh, send me coffee, why don't you? But don't do that. Someone else had actually offered to do that once from Hawaii. Really, really tempting, but, you know, it just doesn't make good sense to send coffee to me. It's just not economically efficient, and it's kind of pointless to, you know, send coffee. I mean, I've got plenty of coffee here, so don't worry about it. But don't let that diminish the appreciation that I have for this cup of coffee. It really is quite good. Wind Farm Coffee. It's comes in a fancy brown bag with earth tone labels, which says to me it must be socially conscious and healthy. So yeah, anyway, it's really good. So first of all, some, I guess, community news or listener feedback or whatever. SELF, of course, Southeast Linux Fest, is starting to gear up. It's really starting to get near the time of SELF. So if you haven't made your plans or if you haven't decided whether you're going to take the trouble to go to Southeast Linux Fest, now's probably a good time to start thinking about that, talking to people who kind of determine whether you're able to go do something or not. You should do that now, because SELF is a really cool festival. It's just such a fun festival. There's a lot of people there, a lot of Slackware people there, nice bunch of people, actually. And they get great speakers. There's always something to do there. It's a pretty intense festival, actually. It's one of the busier, kind of more packed festivals, which, you know, is good on one hand, sort of overwhelming on another, but as long as you just take it easy and make sure that you're in the talks that you find interesting, it all pretty much works out. So, SELF is fairly soon. It's like June or July or something. I don't know. You could probably go to southeastlinuxfest.org to find out. But all I know is that they're starting to send me files for the program guide, so that must mean it's going to happen soon. So it is going to happen soon. Make sure that you get down there, and if you are down there, of course, say hi to me, and maybe I will see you there. I don't know if I mentioned on the last episode. I kind of meant to, but I think I might not have. But I've been kind of playing around with GNOME and, GNOME 3 and Unity lately. Simply because, well, Unity I kind of stumbled into because I was commissioned to write an article on Ubuntu. And so I had to run Narwhal, which is 11.04, I think. So I used beta 1 and 2 of that in order to complete these articles that I was writing. And Unity came on that by default, so that was the one that I used. I have to say that Unity is pretty darn interesting, actually. It's at first glance, I actually liked it a fair amount. Not enough to switch from KDE to Unity, but, I mean, it was an interesting idea. And it is actually the impetus of this segment. I want to talk about something that I noticed within Unity and even GNOME 3, but Unity kind of made me think of it first. So it's an interesting idea, and I really like the global menu bar. Really, really love the global menu bar. That's what they're calling the menu bar at the top of the screen. It's an endlessly confusing, baffling idea to me that people want a menu on every single window in their operating system. I don't understand how that's lasted this long, especially since Mac has not had that for, like, I don't know, since probably 1984 or so. It's just why you would want to waste your vertical screen real estate on a menu in every single window that you have open is way beyond me. To say nothing of the fact that how confusing it gets when you look at your screen and you see like 10 different file and edit and tools and settings and window and help menus. You know, I mean, how can you even deal with that? My brain overloads the minute I look at my screen and I see 5 different file menus. To say nothing of the fact when I'm not really thinking. I mean, you know, I'm driving my computer, as it were, and I'm not really, you know, my hand is going quicker than my brain, and so I see, you know, it just clicks on the first file menu that it sees. And suddenly I'm not clicking on the file menu of GIMP, I'm clicking on the file menu of the Conqueror window in the background. And it's just, it's crazy. It makes no sense. And I'll never understand why you would ever need a file menu in the background of anything. If it's not focused, if that window doesn't have focus, then why do I care if it has a menu or not? It just makes no sense to me. So I feel very strongly that this whole multiple, every window has its own menu idea is just, it's wrong, really. It's just absolutely wrong. It's incorrect. It's the wrong way of doing things. And it's probably one thing. If we have to give Apple one thing, then that's the one thing that we can give it. Global menu. They never did the multiple menu thing. It's a bad design decision from probably Windows. It just doesn't work. Bad idea. And feel free, email me. Go ahead. Email me if you disagree. But I'm right on this one. This one I'm not going to move from. Because I've tried it both ways. You know, I've had the global menu bar all my life on Mac, and I totally tried to get into the idea of having multiple menus in my Windows. I've given it the old college try. I've totally tried it. For a good, like, 3 years, I've tried it. And it just doesn't, it's not growing on me. It just gets worse every day. So the good thing about KDE, one of the many good things about KDE, is that you can actually, and K applications, even if you're just running KDE within Fluxbox or something, is that you can ditch those windows, those menus. Usually it's Control-M, sometimes it's Control-Shift-M, but you can usually hide the top menu bar from the application. So typically what I've been doing lately is, once I get really, really used to an application, you know, like, let's just say console, for instance. I know most of the keyboard shortcuts in console that I'm going to use. You know, I've learned all the tricks in console that I'm pretty much going to use on a regular basis. I figure it's a safe time for me to turn the menu off. So hitting Control-M makes that top menu bar go away, and suddenly you don't have a top menu bar in console anymore. You can do the same thing with Conqueror. You can do the same thing with Kate or Kwrite. You can't do it on GTK applications as far as I know, so those still have menu bars, but at least the K apps, I can get rid of those menus and not have to look at them. But to be fair, I could sacrifice one strip at the top of my screen for what they're calling a global menu bar, and that's what Unity brings, and it is quite nice. The only complaint I would have about it, and it's minor, is that in Unity, the global menu bar goes away if you're not hovering over it, which on one hand you'd think, yeah, that makes sense. You don't really need the menu bar till you need it, right? Well, actually wrong, because I find that when I'm, like, I was writing about Shotwell, and so I had to play around with Shotwell for a while, and I was finding that I couldn't seem to get myself to remember that there's a menu bar up at the top, even though that's what I'm used to and everything. That's what I like. But if you don't see it, even out of the corner of your eye, I think, you don't remember it's there. So, I mean, I was trying to figure out how to import a photo into Shotwell for like a good 10 minutes before I realized, oh yeah, there's that menu bar up at the top. If I hover over it, and I can probably go through the menus and figure out how to do this, and sure enough, I did. But not having it there anywhere on the screen, it kind of hurt. And the same thing is true, I think, with Synfig. If you've ever used Synfig Studio, which is an animation program, it's GTK, but they do a cool thing where they hide the menu from you. It's like this little button on the upper left corner of the main window. I mean, it's kind of nice because it's not in your way, but at the same time, it's really hard to remember that it exists. And so when you're sitting there thinking, now how do I add a rotation layer to this animation? And you're just kind of sitting there thinking, trying to remember how you did it last time, and then suddenly you remember, oh yeah, there's that hidden menu up in the left, and then you go there. So on one hand, it kind of works, but on the other hand, it doesn't quite work. So I think that the menu needs to be there, but like I've already said, emphatically, it only needs to be there once. So that was actually not my point. That was just a review of Unity, I guess, or less so. It was a review of the concept of the global menu bar and why it's the right way of doing things. The other thing that Unity actually made me think of has nothing to do with any of that, and this is something that I noticed in both Unity and GNOME 3, and that was this very simple design concept, and that is to give people one way to do things, which seems completely wrong, and I don't actually agree with it, at least not to, I mean, to a point I disagree, to a point I agree, I guess. But the thing that I was noticing about Unity, especially since I was having to write about it, was that every time I wanted to tell someone in the article how to do something, I found myself writing the same exact thing. I mean, like, verbatim. Go to the top left corner, click on the Ubuntu logo, and from the application menu, select so-and-so, or type into the search bar, such and such. And it was then that I realized, I mean, at the point where I was starting to just copy and paste that sequence of steps, I realized that there's an idea in design, in interface design, that in order to make people remember something, you force them into a corner and both literally and figuratively in this case, but you force them into a corner and tell them that there's only one way to do it. And after they've done it 5, 10, 15 times, because that's the only way they can do it, then suddenly it becomes easy for them because they've done it that way 15 times now. Contrast that to operating environment like KDE or Fluxbox, where you have really a lot of different ways of doing things. You know, I mean, think about the different ways people use Fluxbox. They've got a keys file where they've got their little key bindings. They might have a little dock set up for themselves. They might have like a shortcut set up in their slit. They might have, they might launch something from a command line. They might have a menu that they can right click and make magically appear and select the application from there. Lots of different ways to get things done. KDE is the same way. They've got, I mean, they're kind of almost infamous for how many different ways there are to get one task accomplished. Of course, fans of this method would be like, hey, I like that flexibility. That way I can choose the one way to do something that I like and just keep doing that. Or maybe there's not a one way that I want to do something. Maybe I want the flexibility and I'm actually going to use the flexibility so that I can do one thing five different ways, depending on the moment and the context of it needing to be done. Now, in my mind, I keep thinking, well, give me 10 different options, and if need be, I will whittle it down to one. I think, however, in practice, what happens is that when I'm showing Linux to a new user, or trying to acclimate someone who is using Linux to actually using Linux, they'll ask me something. You know, how do I launch an application? And the first time I'll tell them the way that I think it would be easiest. Or the way, rather, that I think it will be easiest for them. So that might be, oh, well, go over here. I've set up a dock for you. You can just click on the icon. Maybe they like that. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're really receptive to that. And then because they're receptive to it, I think, okay, cool. They like that dock. Well, maybe I'll give them that other cool way because they seem to be pretty smart. So I'll tell them the other way. And so then the next time when they ask, how do I launch that application again? I'll tell them, well, let's do it this way this time. Go up to the menu and select it from the category and then find the application there. Oh, they seem to be okay with that. Well, I'll tell them the other cool way to do it. Just hit meta space and type the name of the application. And so what I think an experienced Linux user starts to venture out into new ways of doing things, maybe sooner than their little pupil or their trainee is actually ready to venture. And so we end up giving them, and I'm supposing that other people do this too. I know that I do it. So I'm proposing that possibly we start giving people too many options because we can handle them. We're experienced. We like options. We're excited about them. We want to show the person all the different cool ways there is to do something. The end result is that by the end of the day, when their mind is reviewing what they've learned on Linux today, all they see is like 10 different ways to do the same action. Obviously, if we're throwing them in front of GNOME 3 or Unity, where the only apparent way to do something is to go up into the left corner and get your little, actually it's not little, it's huge, it takes up the whole screen, your big system, do everything menu, then that's the way they do everything. And they do that 10 times, and then when their brain reviews what they've learned on Linux, all they see is their little mouse cursor going up to the left corner, getting this big all-encompassing menu where they can do stuff. There's actually a lot of power in that, I think. And I don't know that it's necessary to write that into the code, you know, to force people to only be able to do everything that one way. I don't know if that's exactly the answer, at least from my perspective, but I think that there is that they make a good point. That if you're showing something to someone on Linux, then repetition is the answer. You know, simplicity almost equals repetition, I think, which is what GNOME and Unity don't seem to agree with. But I think that based on their findings, I think that we could say repetition equals simplicity. And when you're asking what a simple interface is, I think the answer might be an interface that allows you to do the same thing over and over again, the same exact way, time and time again, until it's gotten drummed into your head and that that's the way you do it. Now, maybe after that, way, way in the future, you explore other ways of doing this. But at first, it's repetition, doing the same thing over and over again, the exact same way, each and every time. And it starts to get into your head that that's the way that you accomplish that task. And there's a lot of power to that, because that works. That's the way that we learn. We learn by repetition. Again, I don't know if that needs to be hard-coded into the operating environment. I also don't know if it shouldn't be. Maybe that's the way to do it. Maybe that is the right way to do it. Hard-code it, force people into that methodology. For Canonical, I think that's, I really kind of see why that would be the way to do it. Because then you're creating the Ubuntu way, right? If someone says, how do I launch an application? You do an internet search for that. How do I launch an application on Ubuntu? And you don't get five different hits, how to do it on the command line, how to do it from the application menu, how to do it from a dock, how to do it from a custom launcher, how to do it from a .desktop file. You don't get those results. You get one result. That is, go to the left corner, click on the Ubuntu logo, find the application you want, launch it. That's great. I mean, that's a brand. That's a specific, consistent way of doing something. And there is, I think, a lot of power to that for the beginning, for the beginners. I don't recall that Unity's big, all-encompassing screen full menu was quite as good as GNOME 3's, because at least on GNOME 3, you got a list of everything on your system. Whereas I think on a Unity, you had to go to, like, more applications or something weird like that. That seemed like an unnecessary click to me. Overall, I guess, to sort of wrap up this meandering review, as it were, it's not really a review, I guess, but it had concepts from both GNOME 3 and Unity in it. Overall, I'd say that Unity and GNOME 3 were really sharp looking. They're really, really nice. They look up to date. You know, they got that black, smoky look to them, the really nice dark glass look or whatever that is, that both, Vista 7, Windows 7, I guess, and OS 10 both have that in some places. So it looks really up to date. It looks modern and pretty. It is simple. Honestly, I'm going to venture to say that I think I like GNOME 3 better than GNOME 2, so that's a big deal, because I really don't like GNOME 2 very much. It looks really promising. I used it off and on just for kicks on the Fedora 15 beta, but I didn't spend a whole lot of time in it. I did notice, and I said this last night on Linux Kernel Panic, Oddcast, that I did notice that once I started multitasking to any serious degree, it seemed like my workflow started to really slow down. It didn't help that I was working off of a live CD, but I wasn't quite where I needed to be, I don't think, with switching applications, switching desktops, things like that, you know, triggering applications. The workspace wasn't quite customized for me enough. Having said that, if they give me a lot of customization, the ability to do quick keyboard shortcuts and stuff like that, I can see myself being happy in GNOME 3 if I had to use it. Unity, I'm not so sure about, but the global menu bar, as I've already stated, really, really cool. So hopefully some other desktop environments on Linux will steal that idea from Unity. Okay, I think it's time for a coffee break, so let's go get a cup of coffee. Did I mention I was drinking Wind Farm coffee? Yes, the coffee from Pokey, the man with the HPR stickers. If you haven't received an HPR sticker from Pokey, you should hunt him down and ask for one, because the guy is crazy. He can't get rid of his HPR stickers fast enough. So I wanted to talk a little bit about WordPress, because WordPress is a project that I've actually got a lot of respect for. I haven't used it all that much. I haven't really ever felt the need to use WordPress, but I've seen a lot of people use WordPress, and I'm talking about people who don't go out looking for software to use. I'm talking about people who would, for instance, a couple of years ago, I would get hired a lot to show people how to use their, of course, Macs, because that's what I know. So I would be doing that as a freelance kind of thing, showing them how to create a site for their art project or for their independent movie or whatever they were doing. And even other people, I mean, like a dance studio, just random stuff, you know, totally, I mean, fairly artistic, but but pretty random. And of course, the Macs at the time, and probably currently, had an application preloaded on the Mac. If you purchased it, came with the Mac. It was called iWeb. It's an easy to use, completely abstracting all of the code and concerns of layout from the user. So it's a complete just drag and drop kind of build your own website application. And then the idea was that they would also then subscribe to the MobileMe account and be able to push their designs to an Apple server somewhere, and they could purchase the domain name, and then they could have their own website. I mean, it was really an all-in-one solution. It couldn't get much easier than that. And yet, I'm not lying when I say that a couple of people, more than one, actually would mention WordPress to me somehow. I don't know how they knew about it. I think maybe their friends had it or something. I really don't know how they found out about it, but they literally wanted to switch over from this iWeb solution to, for instance, WordPress. I can remember two instances specifically of people who did that, a few more after I started catching on and started mentioning WordPress. It's a really, really important project because it just seems to be easy, you know, really well designed, easy to use, easy to understand. People can use it. Yeah, I just can't say enough good things about WordPress. Now, that said, I recently was actually setting up a test server for someone. They were doing a WordPress site for not just themselves, you know, it was for like an organization. And she, it's kind of my job to manage the server stuff here. So she asked me if I could set up what the best way to develop on WordPress would be without everyone seeing what she was doing, you know, right away. So she wanted a test bed. So I told her we could set up a test server, which I did on a G4. I think it was like a 877 megahertz. It was the mirrored drive door G4. It might have been the wind tunnel. I forget which one off the top of my head. But yeah, it's a G4. Put Debian on there and created her an account, did a quick install of WordPress, and when I say quick, I mean quick. Took me a little bit longer than like a 5-minute install. I think that's what they pitch, or maybe that's Drupal. One of those two projects pitches it as a 5-minute install. It took me a little bit longer than that, but I imagine if I was doing this all day, I would get it down to 5 minutes. Well, heck, you could probably even script it and get it down to less than that. But it was an easy install, very, very easy. And then it was up and running, and she started doing her development. And for about 2 months or so, that was, you know, she was developing on this G4 box from within the building. It didn't have to be accessible from outside. It was just a inside work kind of thing, and everything was okay. And then recently she came to me and said, hey, I want to transfer the WordPress site that I've been working on now to online. I want it to go live. And I thought, wow, I guess that means I need to learn how to migrate WordPress. So I said, okay, no problem. Came back to my little computer and started looking into how to migrate WordPress. And it was shockingly easy. It was the easiest migration I've ever done. Come to think of it, it might be, yep, it's the only migration I've ever done. But it was really, really simple. So the way that you can migrate WordPress is essentially, the first step is to grab a dump of your database information and your WordPress data itself. Two separate files that you're going to get from your old server. Next step is to modify the database information to match the information that will be true for your new server. And the third step is to transfer all that information to the new server by importing the database into your new database and simply untarring, copying, and then untarring the WordPress folder on your new server. And then the fourth step is to edit the wp-config file and have it match the new database server information. That's it. It's four steps. So the first thing that you do is you go onto server number one. And this, of course, could work on, I mean, if it's a test server and you're pushing it to the real World Wide Web, or if it's simply a host, you know, maybe you've got a free trial of a DreamHost account, or I shouldn't mention names, I guess. Well, who cares? If you had a free trial of, like, DreamHost or something, and you had a WordPress site set up there, and then you wanted to move it over to, I don't know, Bluehost, because their pricing was better or something. So you could do it from World Wide Web to World Wide Web. It doesn't matter how you're doing it. The point is that you're moving the data off of one physical box onto another physical box. So the first step was simply, and this is all online as well, but I mean, this is how I did it, and it seemed to work for me, and this is what I found online. So I feel pretty confident about advising this to you. So the first thing I did, I SSH'd into the test server. And I did a MySQL dump, and that is actually the command. It's simply MySQL dump, space dash P, meaning prompt me for the password, space dash dash user equals root, which was the root name of my MySQL database on this test server, space db space, I don't know, my WordPress database, and then redirect that to, for instance, my home directory slash WordPress database.txt. And what that does is it grabs everything in the database as of, you know, the moment that you issue that command. It grabs everything in that and dumps the contents into a plain text file. I've just saved it to my home directory, so then I would CD over to my home directory. Now, what I did at this point was probably wrong, but it's one way of doing it. There's probably a much more graceful way of doing this within MySQL itself. But in this plain text file, right now, all of the links are based off of the test server. So, for instance, I've got, I didn't even have a domain name for this test server. It was just 192.168.5.5, which is fine, except that within WordPress now, all the links are basically hard-coded with 192.168.5.5 as the root of everything. As far as it knows, its server name is 192.168.5.5. Well, that's going to be wrong because we're about to transfer it to some other place. So we need to change the 192.168.5.5 to whatever our actual root would be. So in this case, maybe it would be migratedomain.com instead of 192.168.5.5, and then maybe we might even have it nested within a folder within that server. So maybe it would be slash, I don't know, WP slash. So whatever you need everything to be relative from, that's what you would want to change your root server name to in that database file. I'm sure there's a way to do that in MySQL, but I don't know MySQL, so the best I could do was get a dump of everything in it and then just go in with plain text. And I literally, in Emacs, just did a find and replace. Just meta x replace string and get everything that says 192.168.5.5 to suddenly say http://www.migratedomain.com. And that worked. That worked brilliantly. There were, I think, 1,415 instances of these, so it is something that you'll probably want to use some automated function for. But it worked without a hitch. There was no problem with that. But you have to do that, because if you don't do that, then you'll be posting your site, and the index page will probably work, because you can go to that directly, but then whenever you hit on a link, it's going to keep trying to find some place called 192.168.5.5 or whatever the case. Now, in real life, if everything in that database was relevant, relative to, let's just say, GNUWorldOrder.com, let's just say ogcastplanet.org, and you're migrating not just the WordPress, but also that domain, like your new server is going to be your domain, then you won't have to change anything because the paths will still be relative to GNUWorldOrder.org. But if you're moving just the database and the actual domain name is going to change, then you would want to make sure that domain name changes in the WordPress database. Got it? Okay. So what we have now is a plain text file that is the database containing everything that your WordPress blog contained. The next step, since we're on the test server still, is just to tar up the database itself. Easy to do. Usually it's in, well, it's wherever your HTML files are. In this case, it was in /var/www/migratewordpress-site. Wherever that is, whether it's in, you know, public_HTML or /var/www or something else, you want to tar the entire folder up. So that was simple. It was finding the WordPress folder and then doing a tar-cf-wordpress-backup.tar migrate WordPress site. And suddenly you get tape archive of the WordPress sources that you're trying to migrate. You might want to bzip that as well if you're transferring it over the net, if it's big. I don't think I did. It was not all that large. I might have. I don't really remember. But whatever the case, you've got it now, and then you want to send that WordPress data to your new host. Easiest way to do that typically would be SCP. You could also do it via FTP. Whatever you do, you need to just sign into your new host and then copy over the WordPress.tar to that host, to the new server. Now, once all that is there, you basically have everything in place. You've got all your WordPress files, you've got all your custom themes and everything like that, as long as this person's been playing nice and doing everything the WordPress way. Everything's there. Once you'd obviously have to unbzip it and untar it, but, I mean, in theory, you should be able to go to, you know, mynewserver.com/migratewordpress site, and you should see at least the front page of your WordPress blog. The index.php should be there. It may or may not have any of the content that it thinks it should have, but the file is there. So then you need to work on the back end of the server and establish a database. It's going to be an empty database. So you can do that a couple of different ways. You can do it either at a MySQL prompt, or you can do it with my PHP admin. I did this with my PHP admin because the server that I was moving it to actually had that available, and I kind of had to do it that way. But the idea either way, whether you do it on the command line or in some kind of GUI, it's the same idea. And the idea is that you're going to create a database, and it's going to be empty, and then you're going to import all the data from this plain text file that we got in the very beginning. It's really, really simple to do this. You simply issue the import command in my PHP admin panel thing. It's simply clicking on import, and then you tell it where the file is, which should be on your local computer, and then you upload it. And it parses it, it figures everything out perfectly, and suddenly all of your data, and you'll see all the tables appear, like all the database itself will be, you know, whatever, MySQL, WordPress database, and then you'll see all the little subtables that WordPress creates, you know, WP underscore users, WP underscore, I don't know, config, I'm just making these up, but a whole bunch of little tables fly in. They're right there. That easy. So you click save or whatever. Okay, I forget what the button is on PHP admin. And now you've got your database and your WordPress on the new server. Final step is to make sure that they're aware of each other. And the way that you do that is in the WP config file. In fact, if you try to go to your WordPress site right now, it will, and I think you might have to click a link to get to the error message. I could be wrong about that. But if you go to the site at this point, it will actually very helpfully tell you what's wrong. It will say, you've tried to access this WordPress page, but we've encountered an error. Perhaps check your WP config, or something really helpful like that. I mean, it spells it out. And so then if you go back into your server, into the new server, and you look just right there at the root directory where WordPress, all the WordPress files is, you will actually see a WP config file right there. You open that up in a text editor. It's human readable. It's really, really simple to understand. I didn't even have to look this one up online. It was just literally, I figured it out from what WordPress was telling me and what I saw in the text editor. And the idea is quite simply that you need to change the values in the WordPress config file so that they now match your new database. So if my database, the actual MySQL database itself on my test server was called MyWP database, then WordPress knows that database. And if the password was foo and the user was bar, then WordPress is looking with that information to access your data. Now if you've moved it to the new server and you had to create a database on this new server, chances are it's not your own install of MySQL. It's probably running on a completely different set of servers over there at the web host. So it's probably a little bit more constrained. They've probably got certain things that they kind of force upon you. And it might be, for instance, a common one would be like your account name and then underscore some unique database name that you are permitted to create. So all your databases are going to have some kind of unique string at the beginning or at the end, or they're going to be on a different server. Something about them is going to be different. So you're going to need to kind of look at the information that you are creating a database on your web host. You need to look at that, and then you can enter that information into the WP config. And it really is, it sounds more complex than it actually is, because if you're looking at the WP config file, you will see exactly where there's an entry for the server located, you know, where the database itself is located, what the database is called, what the username is, what the password is, and that's it. That's the information that you enter, and once you do that, your site is now live and healthy and connected, and it will work as if though it had never changed hosts. Really, really cool. And it literally took me longer to explain it in this segment than it did for me to actually do it without ever actually having done it before. Up until then, I'd never done a WordPress migration before, and it took me no time at all. It was pretty phenomenal. So if you ever have the opportunity to migrate WordPress or anything with a MySQL database or similar, then don't be too afraid. It's actually manageable, it's pretty easy, and it works. Okay, so this listener feedback's just kind of on my mind. I probably have a couple more that I'm missing, but I've emailed them back, and I haven't emailed this guy back. So, but he gives a really good, I guess, clarification on the rsync server setup thing. I think that maybe I was either unclear or plain wrong about the DHCP part. So he says that while your directions for assigning a static IP address for the rsync server will work, I don't believe it is technically 100% correct. After you edit your /etc/network/interfaces to take a static IP address, so that's on the server itself, the rsync server will no longer ask the DHCP server for an address, regardless if the server is a router or a dedicated DHCP server. Therefore, creating a reservation on the DHCP server is somewhat ineffective. However, it does tell the DHCP server to hold that IP from the other client. So in that respect, it does work. Okay, so that is what I'm doing, actually. So I set on the server itself, okay, you're going to be bound to 192.168.7.17. And then on the DHCP server, I told it that the MAC address of the server is going to be bound to that IP address. So he says that there are two ways that he typically handles the servers and static IPs on his network, and this is how he does it. Method one is that he creates, or I'll read it in his words, I create a DHCP reservation exactly how you did in this episode and leave DHCP enabled on the client/server. As long as the DHCP service is up and running, the server will take the IP address I've reserved for it. Additionally, I typically like to segment my servers away from my workstations, i.e., keeping my servers in, for instance, 192.168.1.90 through 100 range, which would provide the organization of the machines so that he could find the server quickly. I've kind of fallen into that anyway. I think that you don't even need to be a pro to kind of figure that that's a good practice, you know, to actually keep all of the servers that do sort of company-wide serving kinds of duties in one group, and then another group of maybe just the admin people, you cluster them in the 20 through 40 range, and then the editors, all the video editors should be from, 50 to 80, or, you know, stuff like that. Just kind of a logical division in your own mind so that you know, oh, an editor's complaining about their internet not being there. Well, let me see if, you know, I know that their IP address must be within this group. So I've done that. So method two, he says, is I adjust DHCP's scope to only assign addresses within a given range, i.e. 192.168.1.20 through 192.168.1.255. Then I will statically assign all of my network equipment and servers to run on the addresses outside of that scope. In this example, between 1 through 19. Using this method, I do not need to make a DHCP reservation because DHCP just doesn't assign any address outside of that known scope. He would just have to take caution not to assign two pieces of hardware to the same address. So in that situation, he's the DHCP server. He's saying for anything within the 192.168.1.1 through 19, he's managing those addresses. If he screws up and assigns a server, you know, one server 18, and then the next day assigns a different computer 18, then there's going to be a conflict. But at least he knows that it's his own fault. And then the DHCP server itself is only handing out addresses from 20 and above. I'm doing that a little bit too. So probably what I'm doing in real life is I'm combining 1 and 2 needlessly because I actually don't have the DHCP server aware of anything I think below 40. So I guess also assigning a static IP address within the DHCP server conf to assign that MAC address 17, I think that's probably completely either being ignored, I hope, or it's probably causing unnecessary errors. So I guess I'll go fix that. So that's what Imperius 1 says about static IP and DHCP stuff, which is really helpful and well explained, and sometimes you need someone to sort of go through it like that with you because you know you're doing the right thing and that it's working, but sometimes you're doing like an overkill or sometimes you're not doing enough or whatever. So that was really helpful, actually. So thanks for the email, Imperius1. Anyone can feel free to email me. Again, I know I've said it before. I'm going to say it again anyway. I don't always answer emails on the show because I forget about them, but I always answer emails. If not on the show, then I answer them in real life. So no worries. Email me away. Love getting email. So do that. There's great little t-shirt company out there. You may have heard of them, Silver Eclipse. If you go to silvereclipse.com, you can see all the stuff that they have to offer. It's a really cool company. I met these guys at OLF the first time. They made my GNU World Order t-shirts for me, and they are just really neat guys, and they do all of this stuff by hand, and it's a really involved process and very sort of craftsman-y and DIY, and it's really neat, and they've got some trade secrets that they kind of developed on their own, as far as I can tell, like some of their bleach processing and stuff. It seemed I haven't really seen it done anywhere else, so it's really neat stuff, and it's that sort of independent feel of, you know, I just like the feeling when people ask me, hey, where'd you get that shirt, and I'm like, oh, a friend of mine made it for me. You know, that to me is really cool, rather than answering, oh, I got it at a big department store, or even just like, oh, I got it at a little store down in the, you know, hipster part of town that not too many people know about, except every hipster in America, but, you know, normal people don't really know about it, so that's kind of cool, but it's not as cool as just being able to say, my friend Mordency made this shirt. So SilverEclipse.com is a cool store. The reason I'm mentioning it at this point is because normally I've been buying my shirts from them at the festivals. You know, I got a Foxconn Suicide Club shirt. I got a GNU design, I don't know if you've seen the evil-looking GNU head from the FSF site or the GNU.org site. So I've been buying the shirts from them at the festivals, which is great because then you come home with a cool new shirt and you've spent money on independent art and, you know, you feel good. But the other day I was sitting around thinking, gee, I need a new shirt, something that is properly geeky. So I decided to buy a brown coat t-shirt from Silver Eclipse. Brown coat is a reference to Firefly. So I went to their store and I put in my order for the brown coat shirt, and they sent it back to me, or they sent me the order, and it's just really, really nicely packaged. You know, it came in a little box, and it was the shirt along with a really nice looking self, you know, the tags that they make for the shirts, and two free buttons of, you know, various geeky or weird designs, so which I'll put on a backpack or something. So it was really, really nicely, you know, it had that sort of personal touch and everything. So it's really cool stuff, and I'm just saying that I recommend that store if you're looking for geeky or just kind of offbeat t-shirts. So check that out. I sent them a couple of new designs, actually, because I designed the GNU World Order shirt, so I kind of sent them some other designs, and I don't know if they'll use them or not. It doesn't really matter, but you can keep an eye out for those if you want. But you can keep an eye out for those. They're obviously very Linux-y designs rather than the weird designs. I mean, they're weird, but they're not just weird. They're also Linux. And no, I don't get a cut of the profits or anything. It's just recommending them because I like them. This has been the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me on Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can find me on IRC on the Freenode network over in #OddcastPlanet and #Slackware, Slacker Media, lots of places. You can find me on the web at GNU World Order, and you can find me on the web at oddcastplanet.org/GNU World Order.
Don't pay for coffee! Coffee should be free for everyone to take as they please.